everyone. Welcome to the latest episode of the Hubcast. I'm Katie Apple, the Executive Director of Nonprofit Hub and Do More Good, and one of your hosts today.
And I'm Jordan Geisert, Assistant Executive Director and your other host. Each episode of the Hubcast is designed to give you, our listener, ideas and inspiration to move your organization from good to growth. In every episode, we feature a thought leader who is working in or with the nonprofit sector to do more good. Our friends at Bloomerang were so excited to sponsor this episode of the Hubcast because they love small shops. For donor management, email marketing, online giving, and more, Bloomerang has you covered. So if you need a new donor database, check out Bloomerang. You can watch a short demo video at bloomerang.co/demo.
Jordan, I know you are very familiar with Stephen Shattuck, but I am not. I think I met him briefly at Cause Camp in 2019 or 2018, but I've never really sat down for a conversation with him. So I am so excited.
You know, him and Bloomerang are like such big supporters of Nonprofit Hub. They're always willing to help us out. So I was really excited to like just get to talk to Stephen and catch up with him. He's spoken at Cause Camp, I think you said that. And this is like a supersized episode because we just had such a great conversation with him. Stephen has a really great book out that came out last year. It's called Robots Make Bad Fundraisers. It's got a great cover.
It does have a great cover. I've been reading it. I'm almost all the way through it. And I really feel like this could be like a handbook for anybody overseeing or leading fund development for a nonprofit, especially if you are just getting into kind of the use of a CRM or the use of any sort of automation. This book is amazing.
I think every nonprofit can use it. I'm really excited to talk to Stephen about it. And I'm just excited to hear what he has to say and what he has going on these days.
Me too. Let's bring him in.
We have Stephen Shattuck with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
We'll just jump right into it. We want you to tell us about yourself and also tell us a little bit about Bloomerang.
Yeah, well, you did a great job describing Bloomerang. So thank you for that. We're happy to sponsor the hub. We love all you guys over there. So thanks for having me. And basically my job at Bloomerang is to do this kind of thing. I get to talk with cool people like you and just, you know, share some of the things we're learning from our customers and our research that we do independently and our weird little data surveys and secret shopping experiments. So I feel like I won the lottery that I get to do this and get paid for it. So yeah, it's very fun.
That's great.
You had me at secret shopping experiment because I have to say that was my favorite part about this book. Like all the covert, you know, research you did.
Yeah, sometimes our bank will suspend the credit card and be like, hey, what's going on? Why did you just donate to 100 nonprofits in Omaha, Nebraska? Are you okay? I'm like, no, we're just doing a little study. It's okay.
I actually thought about that. Like, wow, that'd be tedious. I mean, that's like a lot of legwork. And just so you guys know, this is Stephen's book, Robots Make Bad Fundraisers. And I almost want to call it a handbook. It's kind of like a handbook that every nonprofit fundraiser especially should have. And a lot of it was built around this $5 experiment. So give us the backstory. How'd you think of that? What did it include?
Well, I appreciate that. I think you nailed it. I mean, that's really what I was hoping for is that, you know, a fundraiser, maybe even someone who does marketing and communication at a nonprofit could use it to, you know, avoid pitfalls. It was really my goal because there's so much technology that nonprofits utilize these days that has oftentimes default settings or kind of out of the box template things that might get people into trouble a little bit. And online giving, you know, like you mentioned, Katie, that's a place where things really manifest. I had observed as just being a donor myself, where, you know, I'd go on a beautiful nonprofit's website and with the intention of donating and a lot of friction, you know, sometimes it's hard to donate. Sometimes you have to create an account or, you know, go through a weird shopping cart thing, or maybe you get bounced to some other scary looking page.
Somewhere else.
Yeah. And then after donating, some weird things can happen, right? You get these very scary looking receipts that don't even say thank you. And it's not a very good kind of warm and fuzzy feeling, right? I mean, this is an activity that everybody should be happy about, the donor, the nonprofit. And it just seems like as online giving has gotten more popular and more of these transactional methods of giving, which are good, by the way, there's nothing wrong with them. But if you don't go in and try to humanize kind of the experience for the donor, it just kind of gets the relationship off on a little bit of a sour footing. And, you know, all the donor loyalty research that's out there is basically saying that that relationship really will hinge on those kind of first impressions, you know, how the donor is thanked, how they feel after donating. Are you really capitalizing on those good feelings even after they have donated? And sometimes the technology just gets in the way, and that puts a lot of pressure on fundraisers to, you know, have to really rebound on the thank you letter, maybe a thank you phone call. And why not just go in and start right away, start in those 2 nanoseconds where, you know, you're already sending an automatic email from your online giving provider. So why not make it, you know, not robotic and not a template, and say thank you on it. And that's what the experiments were. That was my goal, to kind of illuminate that and encourage fundraisers to, you know, donate to your own organization and see what do you get? Do you get kind of a scary looking receipt, or do you get a nice kind of gift acknowledgement that really sets the stage for those future communications? And what I found in doing the experiments is very often, you know, I would make 50 or 100 gifts in a random city to a random group of nonprofits. And normally I would just get that automatic receipt, and then that was basically it. And, you know, online giving being on the rise, one thing that's also happening is the first time donor retention rate averages are on the decline. I think that there's a parallel there, because more and more people are donating through these sort of transactional methods of giving. It's they're having a bad experience, is kind of the hypothesis of the book. And so what it does, and you mentioned that, is it just gives some tips that you can do and easily implement to go in and kind of warm up that experience for the donor, even though they're engaging with you in an electronic or a digital way. It doesn't mean it has to be impersonal.
Yeah, it's more than tips, though. I mean, I think people could actually just use this almost as their guide or checklist as they go through setting up an online giving process. I mean, it's really all there.
Yep.
Give the listeners a little background on the experiment, though. Like, how much you gave, how many you went to.
Yeah. Well, I've done a few different iterations, all kind of testing kind of different hypotheses, and also kind of criticism that I received from the experiments, which is good. And it kind of pushed me to try different things. The first thing was simply just making a $5 donation to, you know, 50 random nonprofits in one city, and just kind of seeing not only what the online giving pages look like on the front end, but more importantly, what kind of experience I got after becoming a donor. You know, I was a first time donor to all these organizations. Did they send me the automatic receipt? Did they send me a thank you letter? Did they make a phone call, you know, handwritten note? Just kind of what was the gift acknowledgement kind of average for all these organizations? And for the most part, you know, a $5 gift didn't really generate much beyond that automatic receipt. And kind of the feedback I received was, well, maybe if you gave more, right? Which is an interesting comment to me, is if, you know, we need to value donors based on their gift amount, number one, which I don't think we necessarily should. And two, didn't really matter what I gave, because I was testing all of the automatic kind of functions, right? So if I had given $5,000, I would have gotten the same, you know, automated experience that I suggest people go in and kind of warm up in the book. But, you know, taking that feedback to heart, I have done it for $25 gifts. I have done it where I've made a gift, 2 gifts to the same organization, one for $5 and one for a higher dollar amount, to kind of test that theory, and didn't really make a difference. And another thing I did was I gave a one-time gift to organizations that I was already giving to monthly, to see if they would say, oh, you know, you're a monthly donor and you gave extra, you know, that was kind of a nice thing to do, just to kind of recognize that. And basically that didn't happen. Again, just kind of that automation kept going. So basically what I discovered was, you know, for online gifts, not much stewardship happens beyond what is already being sent in an automated way. And those automated things tend to be very kind of cold and robotic and kind of rote, rather than, you know, going in there and, you know, warming those things up and you know, adjusting those out of the box templates, which is just kind of a one-time fix that may make a really big difference in the eyes of those donors who see those things.
Was there one example that like really stood out to you that you were like, they're doing it right, everyone needs to do this?
Yeah, there were a couple organizations that I'm actually still donating to because of that. And mostly because it can be, sometimes I set up, you know, monthly gifts to see what happens. And, you know, as an aside, monthly giving is just the best for retention, because sometimes it's kind of hard to cancel or you forget about it, which, you know, is good for the org, not to put it too shrewdly. But since you asked, Jordan, you know, one organization called me. One of the rules of the experiments was if they asked for a phone number on the donation form, I had to give it to them, even if it was non-required, because I wanted to see, okay, if they're asking for a phone number, are they going to do it? And the organization you made me think of, Jordan, was the only organization that called me to say thank you. They left a voicemail because, you know, I'm a millennial and I don't answer calls from unknown numbers. Of course, maybe you can relate, but it was nice, you know, and recognize that it was my first gift. You know, Stephen, thanks for your first donation. Notice that, you know, it was the first gift you ever made to us. Thanks for joining the family of donors. I thought that was kind of nice. But it made me wonder, you know, most of those organizations got a phone number from me because they asked for it, but then didn't do much with it. And I just kind of wonder, you know, why ask if you're not going to call? Now, maybe going back to the dollar amount, if I had given $100 or $500, maybe there was some sort of threshold for the phone call. But, you know, you never know what a first-time donor is going to turn into, right? And I don't think that a dollar amount is really a good indication of how much they like you. I mean, they could be a college student where $5 or $10 is actually a lot of money for them. You know, that could be their lunch that day that they are withholding because they're donating to you and they really love you. And, you know, Penelope Burke, it comes to mind. In her research, she found that most new donors don't give at capacity, right? Because it's their first gift and maybe there's not much of a relationship there. Yeah, right. So, you know, and not saying that you need to throw a parade for donors or roll out the red carpet. I mean, there's a lot of really smart people talking about that issue, and I think they're totally right on. But I don't think that going in to your online giving software, your donor database, and changing a very scary looking receipt into a nice thank you message that everyone will get because of it is, you know, is going too much overboard. Right. And there's so many other things in the book that I cover that are like that you can simply go in and just tweak or leverage a little bit more and really give that donor a much better experience because of it.
So let's talk about two of the other things in your book. And Jordan was trying to say these words before we got started, and I'm probably going to butcher them too, but it's like lumping.
Yeah.
And a fast. And I have to say, like, I'm sitting alone in my office. My kids are out in the main area and they heard me laugh when I read that. explain it.
I can't take credit for either name. My good buddy, Beth Ann Locke, helped with the name seg lumping. It was a concept that I kind of identified to a group of fundraising buddies. And I was like, we got to call this something because it's a weird phenomenon. So the seg lumping thing, you ever gotten an email from anyone, a business, a nonprofit, a politician, anything that basically says whether you have done X or done Y, we would love for you to consider either doing X or Y. So an example of this is whether you've already donated or you haven't yet made your donation, would you consider giving to us on Giving Tuesday? And it's kind of a way of lumping together two different groups of people rather than just communicating to one group one way and the other group another way. So it's a way of, instead of maybe segmenting, which segmenting is kind of the inverse of seg lumping, right? These words are ridiculous, I know, but why not say, okay, these people haven't donated yet. Let's send them an email to only them. And here are the people who have donated, but we want them to donate again. Let's ask them to do a different thing. So not lumping everyone together. And it basically just signifies to the recipient that you have no idea which group they're in, who they are, what they've done. And that's not a very motivating thing, right? As a consumer, a donor, as anything really. So don't do that, right? And I know that sometimes technology, it's hard to break those people into groups. Like maybe if you're using Excel, or if you only have like MailChimp or Constant Contact or something, and you're not really sure who in the list has done what action. Yeah, it may be better than asking someone to donate who already has, maybe. But you know, leveraging technology so that you can say different things to different types of people, because for every nonprofit, any business, you know, anyone that serves any sort of customer, amongst those supporters of yours are very different types of people, right? They give for different reasons, they give on different schedules, they give different gift amounts, they might volunteer, not volunteer. So the more you can talk and break all those people into smaller groups so that you can really contextualize your message, that's better than, okay, we're just going to email blast everyone on the list and we're going to try to say all things to all those people and hope that something sticks. That's not really a recipe for success. So if you've ever, you know, sat down to write an email and you find yourself saying, you know, whether you've already signed up for this event or you're still considering it, you know, here's the information. Don't do that.
That's my board. Whether whether you've RSVP'd yet or not, do it again. Yeah.
Yeah. Just grab that list of people and email them separately. So, and then the TASK, I think that it was Lynn Wester who came up with this term, although I think that this is a little still contended of who actually named this thing. Basically, the concept is when you are thanking a donor, you're also asking them to give again. So in your thank you letter for maybe a one-time donation, you include a BRE. So, hey, you know, for your next gift, you can just use this thing. So most people, and some people would disagree that maybe a TASK is actually effective in some contexts, and maybe it's worth, you know, breaking a couple eggs to make an omelet. I am of the opinion that a thank you should be a thank you, right? And you shouldn't cross those streams. You know, you can certainly ask that donor to do something later, but a thank you is a thank you.
I have a theory on that, because I think, I mean, if you think, and I think I'm older than both of you, I'm pretty sure. But if you think back before things were automated, before we had CRMs, before we had donor databases, or at least the majority, a donor thank you could take, I mean, by the time the volunteer in charge of that got to it, it could take 6 weeks.
Yes.
And so I think this old school of thought that timeline is still appropriate and it's then okay to ask again. But man, that's the old way of doing things. And it's,
I think you nailed it. I think a lot of the stuff is an artifact of kind of those analog days. And, you know, nonprofit technology evolved so quickly over the last 20 years and even over the last 5 years in some cases that we're all struggling to catch up, right? And I know we're all overworked and underpaid and burned out. And there's tons of, you know, annoying talking heads like me who are nitpicking at every little thing. But what I tried to do in the book is identify the most low-hanging fruit, like simply going into these things and making a couple of tweaks that will make a world of difference, I think. But yeah, I totally agree with you that And the technology vendors, and there's a section of the book about this, is, you know, they haven't really done us a lot of favors either of kind of helping us through these things. Like maybe those templates out of the box should already be really nice, right? And we shouldn't have to go in and change these things. But it's hard. And you know, any minor improvement that you can make, you know, that's a victory, even if it seems mundane. You know, if you can make one donor, you know, have a little bit better experience, yeah, I think that's worth the time. But what I've identified in the book shouldn't take too long. And that was by design, just because there's so many things that we can be doing at any given moment at a nonprofit.
If you want to avoid the TASK and you just want to make a straight thank you, how long after that thank you do you think is a good, you know, time frame to ask for another gift?
Yeah. So there's some interesting research on this. There was a study that that we did and that Adrian Sargent has done. And Adrian Sargent is a researcher who's been looking at, you know, donor loyalty and donor retention. And for first-time donors specifically, so people who have made their first gift, there seems to be kind of a 90-day honeymoon period kind of window of opportunity that is reliant on you doing a good job thanking that donor. You know, hey, thanks for your thanks for your first donation. You know, we're so happy to have you. You know, a welcome kit, maybe a survey, maybe they've been invited in for a tour. You know, you've done something to kind of get to know them. But the data shows that you should ask that first-time donor to give a second time within 90 days of their first gift. Now, a lot of times when I say that, you know, the person on the receiving end bristles a little bit, like that seems kind of fast, you know, it's only their first gift. But if you have done a good job getting to know that first-time donor, maybe you can contextualize and further personalize that subsequent appeal. So for example, maybe, you know, Jordan, you give on Giving Tuesday to an organization in Nebraska, you give, you know, $10, $15, something like that. You come back March or April, you know, you got a spring campaign. Maybe you have a special need, like, hey, we need a new roof on this gymnasium. If you can come back and say, you know, Jordan, we're so happy to have you, you know, give last Giving Tuesday. We know it was your first gift. You know, hopefully you've been seeing some of the things we've been sending you. We have this special need going on right now. We're wondering if you'd be willing to chip in something. It doesn't have to be much. You know, if you gave another $5 or $10, the fact that you have gone from a first gift to a second gift is really significant, because the retention rate goes from like 20% to 60% from the first to second gift. It doesn't, in a way, it doesn't really matter how much you give. So that may be something that can help you with that ask, rather than, okay, you gave on Giving Tuesday, you just get thrown into whatever ongoing, you know, solicitation cadence there was or whatever thing was planned. And again, it's not sort of personalized for you or contextualized for your last gift. And that can be a symptom of just lumping everyone together right onto that one big list and sending one appeal to everyone and hoping that some people respond. But again, the more you can kind of break those people up, you know, first time donors within the last 6 months, you're asking them again. Your monthly donors, maybe you're asking them for a one-time gift. You know, lapsed donors, you can have a lot of versions of that spring appeal that speaks to those groups. So if you're going to be aggressive on that 90-day window, you got to do it that way. Or else I think people will probably say, oh, geez, they're already asking me. I just gave, like, what is this? I think that's why the appeals fail, not because of the timeline necessarily, but because they aren't, I keep saying this, but personalized and contextualized for that recipient.
Join us for Cause Can't Fall this October. Hear from top of industry speakers, just to name a few: Dana Snyder, who has worked with Movember and Dress for Success; Scott Welch, an expert on how to make DEI practices fun and practical; and Farah Trompeter, who has led dozens of organizations through brand overhauls and fundraising campaigns. See the full agenda at www.cause.camp/agenda. We'll see you there. Now back to the Hubcast.
So I'm thinking about our audience, which is typically small to mid-sized nonprofits. And I'm imagining if we were having this discussion live, like, somebody would bring up capacity.
Yeah.
It's me. I do all the fundraising, or they're the ED and the fundraiser. Talk to us about, I mean, that is not a hopeless situation, but we want you to give us hope. So give us hope.
Yes.
Yeah. I think probably where you would get the most bang for the buck, and I know I keep harping on it, but those first time donors. So a couple of reasons. One is you may already have negative ROI on that acquisition. So for example, if you spend $30 to acquire a $20 gift from that first time donor, you know, you're in the hole $10 already. And I know it's really hard to identify the cost of acquisition for an individual donor. But for the sake of this exercise, that can be hard on the nonprofit, because at a 20% retention rate, you're not going to get a lot of those people back just kind of as a foregone conclusion. So the second gift from a donor is in some ways more important than the first, again, because you, there's such a significant leap in retention rates from 20 to 60, right? And then, you know, much higher chance that they're going to continue giving, and you can kind of, you know, capitalize on that cost of acquisition if there was one. So that's where I would start. And the other thing is that retention rate has been falling for the last 5 years. It was 25% back in 2015. It seems to be getting worse and worse. So for whatever reason, that first time retention, it's just harder to get those people to give a second time. And so not only is there a good, kind of a good business case, but there are some pretty simple things that you can do that won't take a lot of time. One thing we identified at Bloomerang is making phone calls. So we looked at our customers that had high first time retention rates to kind of figure out what it is that they're doing. And the biggest kind of corollary that we found, and I know, you know, causation and all those things, but it was interesting data, was that they were calling those donors to say thank you. You know, a voicemail was just as good. You know, hey, Jordan, thanks for your donation. Saw it was your first donation. Would love to get to know you more, but just wanted to acknowledge that you're joining the family. You know, I'm here if you ever have any questions. Click, 20 seconds, 30 seconds. So what we tell Bloomerang customers is maybe carve out a half hour a week, be on Fridays when maybe things are slowing down or you're feeling a little sluggish, right? And say, okay, who were all our new donors this week? You know, who were the five or six people who gave for the first time? Do we have their phone number? I wouldn't go creep on the ones you don't. That'd be maybe a little weird, but call them, right? Or have your board do it. You know, the beauty of this is actually Penelope Burke, to bring her up again, she found that board members are even better people to call these donors than the staff members. So you could maybe do this without adding anything to your plate other than asking your board to do it and giving them the list and, you know, giving them a little bit of a script. Mm-hmm. The lifetime value and the retention rate increases and all of that flows into revenue over time, that can be really transformational. If you can go from 20% first time retention to 30 or 35%, that could be thousands of dollars and more major gift prospects over time, more request prospects over time. That's where I would start, honestly. You know, if you don't have a nice kind of first time donor welcome or cadence or sort of communication plan, I think people would get a really good bang for the buck there. And then the other thing that I mentioned is go into your online giving provider. Maybe it's your database. Maybe it's like an online giving software standalone thing. And, you know, what does that automatic email look like? Where are you sending donors after they donate? Are they going to a nice thank you page? Or maybe you're trying to get them to do a couple more things afterwards. Are they getting kind of a nice email that says, hey, you know, we're going to send you a thank you letter in the mail. Be on the lookout for that, or be on the lookout for our newsletter. That's a one-time fix. Like, you do that and you're done, unless you want to maybe test it over time, which would be good. But, you know, those two things, that could be really powerful, even for a one person shop that is trying to do everything else. And I feel bad. I mean, that's the Bloomerang crew too. So I know there's so much to do, but, that first time donor side can be a real killer for ROI. Yeah.
That's great advice though. I mean, it's tactical and it's easy. It's not easy, but it's doable. I think
doable. Yep.
You can do that. I want to come back to the stats about the decrease or the decline in first time gifts and recurring gifts. What do you think the pandemic is going to do?
It was interesting. We support a group called the Fundraising Effectiveness Project, and they look at that donor retention, and they came up with their 2020 data a few months ago. And 2020, there were more first time donors in that year than ever before. I think, you know, it was a year of great need. Maybe people were asking more. I think donors just naturally recognized that there was more of a need, and a lot of new people entered the sort of the foray. Now, my concern is that here in 2021, we're already halfway through it. Did we really recognize those people? You know, did we welcome them? Are we, you know, doing a good job kind of stewarding them? Have we already asked them to give again? You know, which hopefully we should. It's been 6 months and maybe longer for some of those people. But what I think is happening on the retention side, even prior to 2020, is it's so easy to donate now, right? It's never been easier to become a donor, you know, online giving, peer to peer. I mean, I can't go on Facebook without seeing a fundraiser that somebody is doing. And I click once, I'm a donor, boom, you know, text to give is so easy. I think that that has created more donors, which is good. And also the cost to acquire those donors typically is lower than other channels like events and direct mail, which are all good, by the way, and I'm not disparaging them. But I think the flip side is that it's a very transactional mode of giving. And again, they may be getting very kind of robotic communications from us, if anything at all, right? A lot of those channels, it's very hard to communicate to those donors afterwards, right? Sometimes we don't get the donor information from the channel. Like Facebook is a famous one where you don't get the information. So how could you steward them if you wanted?
We're going to get an angry letter from Facebook because we've trashed them on every podcast.
I'm on some sort of list, I'm sure, because I talk about this. It's okay. I'm right there with you. But it's a good and bad, right? So you kind of have to take the retention rate with a grain of salt. It's like, well, we're getting more donors. Should we just take the money and run? Maybe some of those people aren't worth stewarding because you can't, for one thing. And it's like, you know, Jordan, if you were doing a 5K in Lincoln, Nebraska.
First of all, let me say thank you for thinking that I could do a 5K.
Oh, I you could. And I just signed you up. So congratulations. And, you know, you're supporting your favorite nonprofit that you really care about, but I'm donating. I don't necessarily care about that nonprofit. I'm just supporting, you know, my pal Jordan. Right. That's a little bit of a leap to assume that I'm going to give a second and third and 10th time. So, and I'm kind of the retention guy, but this is one area where I say, maybe don't worry about it necessarily. Now, if someone comes to your website directly and donates and it's your first gift, maybe there's something going on there, right? That's not necessarily the same as doing somebody's Facebook birthday fundraiser. So again, and you mentioned it, using tools like the CRM can help you. Okay, maybe I'll communicate to Steven in one way because he came in through this 5K thing versus, you know, Sally, who donated to us directly, maybe we should call her and see what's going on. You know, that if you can make that shift in sort of your stewardship efforts, I think that's when some really cool things will happen in terms of loyalty. And it's okay that Steven didn't give because you got his $20 and didn't cost you anything because Jordan went out and raised all the money. So,
and Jordan's cares? Running a 5K.
I'm a runner now. So the last part of your book is literally a crystal ball of your predictions, one of which is the multi-channel renaissance. Should nonprofits be on every platform?
Maybe. You know, whenever I've seen other people get that question, and one answer I see a lot of times is, you know, go where your audience is. Mm-hmm. I think that's a pretty good answer. I think it's kind of hard to know where your audience is. I think sometimes we make a lot of assumptions that, like, oh, you know, only old people are on Facebook or old people are not on Facebook. And it's like, there's always these competing studies that say one thing and the next one says another. And it's hard. I think that, you know, getting to know your donors is a really good sort of antidote to this. You know, you can ask them, you can say, hey, how are we communicating to you? You know, how would you like us to engage with you? Rather than, you know, relying on whatever weird blog post study you found while you were Googling on Saturday night to figure out, you know, when the best time to send an email was, or should I be on TikTok or whatever. But one thing I will say is that early adoption tends to have some rewards. So, you know, if and I don't mean that you should go chasing every new weird, you know, social platform that comes out every time, but, you know, keeping an eye on things. I know this is another thing that somebody has to do in the midst of all their other work, but, you know, keeping an eye on trends, you know, going, listening to podcasts like this and going to webinars and conferences, you know, you may pick up a tidbit that the person sitting next to you or the person in the Zoom, it won't apply to them, but it might really apply to you because of what you know about your unique audience, for sure. But I think it's hard to be good at a lot of different things. You know, maybe you choose, you know, Instagram's going to be our thing, or, you know, we're going to hang our hat on having a podcast. You know, that's going to be our thing. And for Bloomerang, it's, you know, we have a webinar series, and that's kind of where we live, and that's our thing. We could do all these other things, and maybe it will be successful, but we would spend a lot of time and money kind of trying them rather than just kind of sticking to the area that you're comfortable with. So I probably just gave very contradictory advice in this long-winded answer, which is, it's a hard question. And I guess my main piece of advice is kind of be wary of those general studies where it's like, well, the best time to send an email is 4 p.m. And this generation is not on this social network. Well, you may have supporters of that generation who are on that social network because they're the outliers or they're the weirdos or whatever. So just be careful.
It sounds like testing and measuring is probably the safest approach. Like,
I think
go ahead and try, but if it's not tracking in three to 6 months, get off it.
Yep. Yeah. Don't be afraid to cut that off if it's not working.
Yeah. I'm not on TikTok or Snapchat or way behind.
I'm 38. And I don't even know how to create a TikTok. I don't know what to do.
I'm 26 and I've never done a TikTok. So
we're way behind.
What?
That kind of shocks me. I thought you'd be on that.
You know, my sister texts me TikTok videos, but I don't have the app. So I don't know.
That's good enough.
I'm not on Snapchat, but one of our Inspire speakers for the upcoming Cause Camp conference. And I don't know who sent it to me, but they sent me a Snapchat video of this woman giving her kind of testimonial. And I mean, I was out running and I texted Jordan. I'm like, I'm in tears. This is amazing. Yeah. Via Snapchat. It's just gonna be
never know where it's gonna come from.
Sometimes it's just the content. The delivery system is somewhat irrelevant. Yeah. In some cases,
there you go.
You know, yeah. Right.
Very well put. Yes.
Okay, so bring it home for us. What are the characteristics of nonprofits who have mastered good fundraising without becoming, they've mastered automation without becoming robots? They somehow kept that personal connection.
Yeah, I think, you know, to give a real life example is, rather than expecting, you know, software or technology to communicate to a donor for you, that same tool would tell you that this donor is someone that you should consider calling, right? Or maybe asking for an upgrade. Now, the book isn't anti-technology. It's just kind of how you leverage the tools, right? And there's a lot of vendors out there who are like, we'll do it for you. You can set it and forget it. You can go on and go about your day and worry about the things you want to worry about. And I know that can be a very compelling message for folks who are really overworked. But my concern is that, you know, people give to people, right? This is a very relationship-oriented discipline that we work in. And if you replace one of those two humans with a robot or with a tool or a piece of software, my concern is that it's not going to be as effective. So, you know, the wealth screening tools, tools that automatically update your addresses and tell you if someone in your database has passed away, like those, that kind of automation is great. But when it's, we're going to robocall all these people, or we're going to, you know, write an email, the robot's going to write the email for you and send it. If that stuff worries me. And maybe technology in 20 years or 50 years will be at that point that it can do that, but that'll create a whole other set of problems, I assume. But, you know, the more fundraisers are getting out, you know, meeting with people, making phone calls, reaching out personally, emailing people personally, making, you know, videos and things like that, I think the technology should kind of guide your efforts and say, okay, here's Jordan. She's been given the same amount for 5 years. She seems to really like us. Maybe we should ask her to give more. Maybe we should find out, you know, why she gives, those kinds of things. When it can be kind of a teammate and kind of a coach for you rather than, you know, putting you on the sidelines, that I think is the big difference.
Yeah, I get that. It's a tool. It should be nothing more than a tool.
Yep.
So I'm going to hold it up again. Robots make bad fundraisers. And I got my copy on Amazon. It arrived super quick, prime shipping, 2 days, go out and get it.
Yeah, the irony is a robot printed it as soon as you clicked buy and then and shipped it
and
out
I
to
so
you.
Enjoyed how fast I got it. It was so
Stephen, where can people find you?
I'm all over, you know, if you Google Boomerang Stephen, you can usually find me. I'm on Twitter, LinkedIn. You know, I'd love to hear from folks. The book's on Amazon. Not on TikTok. Maybe my son's turning 10. He might be in that sweet spot soon. Maybe he'll get on there. He's a Zoom expert because of all the virtual schooling, which is kind of terrifying. So yeah, that's one of the beauty of having kids is they'll teach you all these newfangled things. It makes you feel so old.
I'm right there with you. I have an 11-year-old and she rivals me with tech savvy. That's for sure.
Scary.
Stephen, thank you so much. This has been awesome. We always enjoy talking to you. You are an authority on fundraising and love bringing your expertise to the audience.
Anytime.
One more shout out to Bloomerang for being our Hubcast sponsor today. Bloomerang's cloud-based donor management software is rooted in principles of philanthropy, simple to use, and focused on empowering your team to achieve remarkable results through enhanced donor loyalty. You can watch a demo video and get started at bloomerang.co.
That was so much fun talking to Stephen. What great advice too. I think I said it before, but you know, authors sometimes try to bait you and they don't give you a full answer because they want you to go buy the book. And Stephen came a lot of way in this episode. Yeah. Great advice, great counsel, and still go buy the book. It's a great book.
You know, when he was very generous with what he gave away, but it only made me want to go buy the book more.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're not supported by traditional fundraising, but even in our communications with our audience, there's so many things that automation and robotics, for lack of a better term, it kind of muddies the water and it lessens the relationship. So it was so informative. He's just an amazing researcher, an amazing author.
You know, Katie, one of my questions I wanted to ask you was, have you ever had like an incredible donor experience, like where you donated to some place and they just like treated you so well that you just wanted to keep going back?
Actually, something crossed my mind when we were talking about the first time donor experience, because and he also referenced that a lot of young donors, you know, they may have big potential, but that initial gift is going to be smaller. And I'll never forget, right after my husband and I were married, and it was the first time I think that we'd both gotten bonuses and we were financially, this is pre-kids, obviously. But we were financially in a really good position and we were able to make what to us was a pretty significant check to rescue mission in our state. And the response was, they sent us a letter and I think we got the letter within a week, which at that time was, I mean, this is 10, 15 years ago. That was pretty radical timing. And the personal letter that was written with it in handwriting, wet ink from the director. And I mean, I think we talk about this all the time. Everybody wants to be seen and valued. And in that moment, especially because that was my first time making a gift like that, I felt seen and I felt valued by that organization. So yeah, I mean,
that's such a great story. And I've had experiences like that too. I feel like, especially when you're young, you know, you don't have a lot, but whatever you do give away is like really significant for you. And I actually donated a bunch of like brand new makeup to one of the women's shelters here in Lincoln, Nebraska. And the ED called me like within an hour. And I was so moved. And I'm a little emotional here, but I've never stopped giving to them. Like every single, you know, year I go back.
Yeah.
And it's just those little tiny things. That one phone call like got them a lifetime donor.
Yeah. Same here. Little bit of investment in the relationship and you feel this loyalty, you feel a commitment.
I want your opinion on this. So on a donation form, do you think it's okay to put the phone number as required?
I think it's just fine. Because we know everybody has a phone number. If you have concern about making it required, you can always put something, you know, we don't do phone solicitation, or something about how you're going to use the information. But the fact that somebody is giving you their credit card digits, which is pretty, you know, that's significant, and there's security issues. I mean, look at what's happened even in the world the last couple of weeks with all the security breaches. I almost want to give my phone number just in case.
Yes.
Like, if you get hacked, I want to know about it.
Please call me ASAP.
Yeah. Yeah. So for that reason, I think it's fine to require it. And I don't think anybody would think twice about that.
Man, this episode was jam-packed with amazing donor experience tips.
It was.
This was a goldmine. I hope everyone loves this episode, because I had the best time talking to Steven and you. I love the Hubcast. It's so much fun. All right, everyone. Well, have an amazing week and get out there and do more good. Thank you for joining us for today's Hubcast. Get more great content to take your nonprofit from good to growth at nonprofithub.org. See you next time.